Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Melvin Gibbs. Gibbs is an accomplished bassist who has recorded as a bandleader, as well as with Ronald Shannon Jackson, Ardo Lindsay, and the Rollins Band, among others. He's also written the book, How Black Music Took Over the World, which is out April 14th. In that work, Gibbs outlines how the music of Africa has shaped sounds around the globe. In this conversation, we discuss the origins of that work, his life as an autodidact, and several of the key components found in the pages of How Black Music Took Over the World. That's Melvin Gibbs on Into Music, coming up now. So I'll kind of start actually with, well, I think, probably an obvious question, but what inspired you to sit down and put this all down on the page?
Well, it's a two-part explanation. Part one goes back to the 2000s, back when Napster hit and the music business fell apart and Radiohead was giving away records and the people in the high end of the music business had stopped making music because they were like, how are we going to make money on this? And that was the point where I was kind of like, okay, what does a viable life looks like? And I started thinking about, okay, what's plan B? And I talked to a friend who was a college professor, and she said to me, oh, you're going to have to take 6 years out of your life to go get your PhD, and then you can go teach. And I was like, that's not going to happen. And a couple of weeks later, I happened to be on the phone with the great composer, theorist, Wodada Leo Smith. And we were talking about various things. And I mentioned this conversation and he said to me, I don't even have my bachelor's. He said, what you need to do is make a curriculum and convince a university that they should use it. So that was the beginning point of me thinking about what I know as a system. So that was the first part. Fast forward a decade plus to COVID, when once again, it was a question of, okay, how am I going to eat? And by that time, I had established a very fruitful partnership with Stefan Alexander, the theoretical physicist who's also a jazz musician who wrote the book, The Jazz of Physics. And I was talking to him about this, and the idea was like, well, maybe it's time for you to write a book. And I started thinking about a book, and I, you know, kind of went through a couple of more conversations with him, and he gave me the proposal that he had developed for his Jazz of Physics book to use as kind of a model of what a proposal should look like. So I took that proposal and made a book proposal for a book that at that time was called The Science of Black Music. Then I reached out to one of my good friends who's no longer with us, the great writer Greg Tate, and I sent him the proposal, and he really kind of fell in love with it. So he tried to connect me with a very high-powered agent who spoke to me on the phone once, and then I never heard from that person again. So I was a little sort of despondent and dejected when I realized I was never going to hear from that person again. And it so happened that Stefan called that day and told me his editor was coming to town and strongly suggested that I print out the proposal I had made and bring it. So I did exactly that, and I gave it to TJ Kelleher that night. And literally the next morning, first thing, TJ called me and said, this proposal is amazing. I don't know what that agent was thinking about. We're going to do this. And that's how it happened.
I, of course, want to talk about the, you know, the kind of more theoretical side of this. But one of the things I love is that you interject elements of autobiography and especially this curiosity that you had as a young man of like, I'm just going to kind of teach myself. Which I think a lot of people can relate to. It just comes to that point where it's like, maybe school isn't capturing your attention, but the whole world has kind of got your attention. That seems to be what you did.
Yeah, that's very much the case. I mean, I was thinking a few years back, I was standing on one of the main corners of Brooklyn. I don't know how many Brooklynites can listen to this, but there's a main corner called Church Avenue and Flatbush Avenue. And right at that main corner, there's a high school called Erasmus High School, which literally is where Barbara Streisand went to high school and Neil Diamond and all of these people. And I was thinking about people like Jay-Z and Nas and Mos Def, and thinking about how many of these people were actually high school dropouts and the fact that school just didn't work for them. But yet they had these great careers, and yet, so many of us are autodidacts. So yeah, it's really, I won't say it's exclusive, it's written for autodidacts, but I would say that part of it is sort of a low-key manifesto that, with proper people vetting what you're doing, teaching yourself can be a very interesting, very great way of learning things that you wouldn't learn otherwise. I mean, the whole tech, a lot of the tech world is based on that. And the idea of tinkering, experimentation, which people only think of in terms of tech, is very much the case for anyone who's trying to figure out something that the system was not designed to let them learn.
Well, I think that dovetails nicely to this idea of evolution, and that idea that evolution is really just about a problem getting solved, whether it's in music or painting or something like that.
Yes, that's very much the case. That, and that's the almost a literal quote from one of the other people who framed the book, the evolutionary biologist Brandon Ogbunu, who teaches at Yale, who says that evolution is solving whatever problem people. He said people think that evolution is teleological, meaning that it has a goal, but evolution does not, in fact, have a goal. Evolution is solving whatever problem is in front of it, and that really kind of dovetails, as you said, dovetails with what we're talking about, and particularly dovetails for the experience of Africans in America.
Tell me a little bit more about that as you see it, as this musical change or musical evolution as it applies to Black people in America.
It's embedded in the bigger problem that Black people in America had and continue to have, which is being considered human. Being considered human beings, being considered fully human, being considered fully systematically. So, yeah, so the book is really an example of, and a larger level, an example of the examination of what that process looks like. And, and music is a representative of the larger effort of Black people to exert their humanity. It's funny, we were talking today. I'm here at Brown University today. The person I'm doing a duo show with, Arto Lindsay, gave a talk, and he posited this idea that asked, why is it that so much great music comes from poverty, from poor circumstances? And I said to him, well, I mean, in my view, it's exactly the opposite. In my view, humans come into the world, and the world is kind of inherently beautiful for humans, for people. But this idea of capitalism, this idea of poverty, gets imposed on top of the idea of this sort of inherent beauty of living. So the inherent thing is that people are going to do beautiful things first, so instead of, okay, now we're going to create poverty first, because poverty only exists in the context of how people creating a society. And before there was a society, there was just people. There was plants, trees. So this whole idea of poverty, it doesn't really, it's an idea that's created later. I'm saying all of that to say that, as Black people came into America, this idea of them being enslaved, this idea of them being lesser, that was in an idea that was imposed on them. As people, we decided to be people, which meant we were going to make beauty, because that's what people do. And I think the process of making that beauty in circumstances where at first it's suppressed, if anything, it's beyond suppressed, the idea is attempt to be removed. And beyond that, we're grappling with technology, we're grappling with urbanity, we're grappling with all the things that the rest of the world has to grapple with. It ended up becoming this sort of template, musical template of how to grapple with these things. And that's kind of why I decided to use the idea of evolution as the frame, and the idea of how culture evolves as a frame for the music, because that's really kind of, when you talk about how Black music took over the world, you're talking really talking about this process of making relevance. And so that's kind of that's why that be, that's so that's why I decided to use that as a frame as opposed to some sort of business model of in such and such a year. I mean, because that's true as far as it goes, but that still stays within the frame of capitalism, which is kind of outside of the frame of the actual creation of culture itself.
Excuse me, I like what you said because I suppose I've been guilty of subscribing to that idea of that poverty is somehow this thing that creates art. But that, like the myth, I suppose, of like suffering creates great art, those are false because they don't necessarily create great art, and that also perpetuates problematic attitudes and behaviors.
Yes, and I think the process of overcoming suffering couldn't be reframed as the process of reasserting the inherent humanity. So it's not that the suffering is creating the art, it's that the human is overcoming the suffering. You know, the if a I don't in other words, if you had a great artist, they would still make great art if they weren't suffering. It's not the suffering that, you know what I mean? The suffering, it's like, again, you know, that's my thesis because of my life and because of the people that I've seen and the people, as I talk in the book about my dad's cousin, you know, we call them aunts. Any older woman is an aunt, but if we're going to be technical, she's my cousin. About the fact that she figured out the resonant frequency of the building that the church was housed in, and she made the whole church shake by hit. That's the kind of solving whatever problem is in front of it thing that I'm talking about. And that's the thing that doesn't, that's not a question of if she was suffering less, she still would have figured that out. You know what I mean? So that's why it's maybe a useful frame, but it's an incomplete frame. The frame of beauty being first, I feel, is a more complete frame and a more useful frame.
I wanted to ask you about this another passage kind of in the book. It's this idea of people coming to, you discuss this idea of playing music and recognizing what it means to the audience. And I guess I assume that on some level, there's this acknowledgement that some audiences are coming for joy, some are maybe coming for an intellectual experience, maybe some are coming to be shocked, you know, whatever it might be. Can you talk about that a little bit?
As you said, audiences are coming to, you know, see a musical performance for very various reasons. I talk about specifically the people, you know, when I was first starting off, the people that I was playing for were people with jobs, the kind of what we call blue collar jobs, who had a hard week at work, and a lot of whom actually were avocational musicians or had even tried to be professionals themselves. So it was this interesting combination of aesthetic knowledge and cultural insertion in a way that you don't think of when you think of people being aesthetic. So the point being is that they had to be satisfied in a certain, the music had to satisfy them in a certain kind of way. And that way of that satisfaction kind of carried over into the other realms of thinking about music, of even to the idea that people needed to be satisfied by the experience and people needed to be included in the experience. Because there's other schools of aesthetic thought, you know, you talk about art where people don't feel like the audience is even a factor, right? But the way I came up is the audience is part of the performance. And, you know, also being interested in DJ culture, I mean, the DJ, a DJ's whole job is to understand the audience. I mean, that's, you know, that's their skill. So that's kind of inherent in how I think about music personally and how I think about creative endeavors and personally, that it's, if it doesn't communicate, it's not really effective. And that goes over, and, you know, I play like now for the last few years, I've been playing what people consider avant-garde music, but it doesn't change that my basic idea of that the music should communicate with people hasn't changed. I mean, it's even my introduction to avant-garde music was a Sun Ra concert in deep in the ghetto in Brooklyn, and Sun Ra had the people on their feet clapping and dancing. So I don't see the idea of avant-garde is not contrary to the idea of communication in my eyes.
Well, I mean, you use the example of Ornette Coleman. Ornette Coleman's not counting off. He's saying, and play. And then something's going to happen. And if there's an audience there, they're going to have some sort of reaction. Some of it will be physiological. Some of it will be psychological. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Also, coming up as a bass player, who's I think about movement and I think about people. So I think, yeah, the music has to have a physiological component. Music has to actually move bodies for me, So that's the frame of how I started thinking about music. And that's the frame of the people when I first was playing music for. Even if I'm playing jazz, quote unquote, it's still got to have that component of like the people, the audience actually getting into it, involved, invested in it, as opposed to just having some sort of aesthetic experience that may or may not penetrate.
You touch on as well, because of your parents, this idea that a lot of people I don't think of, which is how people in the deaf world interact with music. And as a young man, I had a cousin who was deaf, and he would show up at family gatherings, and he loved to be by the piano, and people thought that was so, and I'm like, no, he feels it,
He feels it. No, I 100% can respond, I can relate to that 100%. Yeah, I often say probably like in some sort of deep psychological reason, I was drawn to the bass because of that, because I knew that, my parents could feel it. And they could respond to it. And like I said in the book, I watch deaf people dance all the time, and they dance on the beat, which used to always fascinate me. It's like, how do they know where the beat is? But then if you feel it, you feel it. And yeah, that's been that idea of vibration has been a very important frame for me as well.
So what role do you see as this broad idea of inclusivity playing? Because I always think of music is about community. Not in a cliche way, but I always think of it as being that great breaker of barriers,
Over the course of my life, it's gone full circle, because on one hand, you want it to be inclusive as possible. On the other hand, you want the communities that actually come up with the thing to be respected. I think for me right now, the best example is I claim two cities now. I claim Brooklyn, New York, where I grew up, and I claim Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is I would say is most where I spend most of my time now. And I happen to be in Minneapolis, living not far from where Renee Good got assassinated by ICE. And when Alex Preddy got assassinated, there was a big one night, in many nights, but I went one night where there were many gatherings of people in the community. We're talking like a couple of thousand people. And every night at that gathering, there was a local brass band called Brass Solidarity that would play. And they would play and people would sing along. And the music that they would play was soul music, kind of civil rights era music, whether they were playing like Sam Cooke songs or Marvin Gaye songs or stuff that reflected the energy of that time, which happens to be resonant with the moment that was happening in Minneapolis at the time. And everyone would sing along. And for me, that was a real current example of what I'm talking about in the book, the power, how Black music took over the world, the power of what music means to an audience, because it gave everybody comfort and it gave people power to move on. And I'm talking about a community, which means everybody. It doesn't just mean the one, the subset of people that created the music or the subset of people that are being impacted in a negative way by the government. It means everybody together moving in the same direction towards a goal. And I think that at its best, music will move people towards a positive goal. And I think that as much as it sucked to be just a regular person in Minneapolis during that time, for me as a creative person, I felt that was a real sort of wake up call for this moment in history where we're dealing with AI and how are we going to move forward with technology. It became like, okay, this is really what music is about. It's not about whatever you scraped off the internet, and it's not about anything. At the end of the day, it's about what's happening right now with this band. We're bonding together a few thousand people so people can go on to the next day with love.
The other thing is you talk about how, Latin music and jazz really can't be notated properly in the Western system. And it was this thing that reminded me, just of how kind of sometimes, well, not sometimes, but how Eurocentric a lot of thinking is. Some years ago, I read this book on mathematics, and they were discussing how in some cultures, counting is even different. Like if you asked how many people were in a village, in some cultures, people would say, well, we really don't think about that because we don't think about each other as separate. So, you know, this very kind of Eurocentric thing that has happened.
That's an important example. Other examples are that people don't always count in tens when people do count. I mean, it's, you know, when you look at a lot of the African mathematical systems, they're binary systems that are actually closer to computer code than they are to the math that we learn in the West. And yeah, it was detrimental to the music, certain ideas of Western thought, like you said, this idea of individuality versus community. You could argue that's one. I think one that's more kind of applicable to the book is the idea of the same thing we're talking about, this idea of the teleology, that things have a goal as opposed to things are being, you know, problems being solved. Because when we look at what's actually, as the idea of evolution being wrong is kind of a throwaway line in the book, but it's actually very important to the general question that you're talking about, which is that you have to let go of the frame that you've been taught to actually see something that does not fit in with your system. So, and the rabbit hole I go down in the book is this idea that syncopation, even the word syncopation, the idea that things that are rhythmic are somehow wrong. And the frame that I like to use doesn't come from African culture. It actually comes from Asian culture. It comes from something called the monkey chant, the chechak, which is from Balinese music. And I love the kind of mythological conceit about that, because the monkey chant is very rhythmic, syncopated, as you would say in Western. But the whole point of it is that the demonic forces can only move in straight lines. So the way you defeat the demonic forces is with the funk, which would be the exact opposite of what somebody who was thinking about, you know, analyzing music in a Western way would say. So yeah, for me, I think about the funk as defeating demons.
You've been listening to a conversation with musician and author Melvin Gibbs. His new book, How Black Music Took Over the World, is out everywhere. Books are sold April 14th. You can learn more about him and some of his recordings at melvin-gibbs.bandcamp.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.